So yesterday, we were talking about the situation of the planet above the surface of Jambu Deep. And we were referring to tables 8 and 9 in the book. So the basic point is that there's a correspondence between the order of the planets above Jambu Deep, as described in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the order of the planets away from the ecliptic, as given in modern astronomy. I was going to explain how that was calculated just when we came to the end of the class, but I'll just give you an idea. If just to say the Earth, and this is the Sun, we're looking at the ecliptic edge-on here. So you can think of this ecliptic as either the plane of the Earth's orbit around the Sun or the Sun's orbit around the Earth, depending on whether you take it from the heliocentric or geocentric viewpoints. So a given planet orbiting around the Sun will be in a plane that has a tilt with respect to this. And that's given the angle of tilt, which would be this angle right here, called orbital inclination, in this column in the table, table number 9. And then there's the maximum distance that that planet will go from the Sun, which say P is the planet.
That angle is relative to what, the celestial equator? Or?
That angle is relative to the ecliptic. In other words, this plane here is the plane of the ecliptic, and this plane is the plane the planet is orbiting in. So those two planes intersect, and there's an angle between them. So that's called orbital inclination here. And then when the planet goes in its orbit, if we look down at the planet's orbit, there'll actually be a point where it's furthest away from the Sun. So that's actually called the aphelion of the planet. That's the technical name. So let's say this distance is the furthest distance it goes to the Sun. So the distance from the ecliptic that I'm talking about in this table then is this distance right here from the planet at its furthest point to the ecliptic.
That distance happens at the same time. That it gets farthest from the Sun at the same time that it's,
I think by definition, happens at the same time as it.
Same time as what?
The aphelion is, by definition, at the time of the greatest sight above the ecliptic.
The aphelion is the point where it's furthest away from the Sun.
But that may not be the same time that it's furthest above the ecliptic.
It follows that it must be.
What if it's not at its elliptical orbit and the ellipses are not... another axis oriented in the same direction.
You're right about that. That's correct. Yeah. Well, in any case, you're correct. That's quite right. In any case, this represents the maximum height that it goes to on this plane as it goes around its orbit. That's the actual point. Yeah. So that's the distance we're talking about. So the basic point then that I made yesterday was that these distances are in the same order as the distances, the same basic size as the distances of the Sun, of the Moon, and different planets above the Bhumandala plane. So this brings us to this point that the Srimad Bhagavatam is saying that the Moon is higher than the Sun, which is a well-known point. So this table shows the Moon, in this sense, being higher than the Sun, and then Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in that order. So that's height above Bhumandala. So if one asks, how does this relate to the picture of the solar system we have in modern astronomy, in modern understanding? And the basic point I'm making then is that if the Bhoomandala plane corresponds to the ecliptic, then the maximum distances that the planets reach in going away from the ecliptic correspond basically to these distances of the planets above Bhoomandala. As closely as I can see, that's the kind of correspondence that you have. Now, I should point out that in the Surya Siddhanta, now, this distance from Bhoomandala is a different thing from the distance between ourselves on the Earth and the planet. The basic point is, in the one case, you're talking about distance from the plane, and in the other case, you're talking about distance along a line. So there are two different kinds of distances that you're talking about there. And the Surya Siddhanta presents the moon as being closer than the sun in terms of radial distance. In fact, it gives the figure for that distance, which is very close to the modern figure. Now that's in the first chapter. I'll just look that up briefly here.
The moon is closer than the sun.
Yeah, closer to us in radial distance.
But it's higher.
But it's higher in terms of distance from Bhoomandala as described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is the situation. Here are the, I'll just write the figures that are given. In the Surya Siddhanta, it gives the circumference of the moon's orbit as 32,400 yojanas. So that's the circumference of the orbit in yojanas. Now, if you want to find the radius of that orbit, then what you have to do is turn this into miles, which you multiply by 5, because it's 5 yojanas per mile in this case. And then you have to divide that by 2 pi, and that will give you the radius, then according to Surya Siddhanta. I have that.
1,000,000.
Let me just do that. It's not written in the book right there. Just to give you what that figure is.
The diameter of the moon, oh, it's in Western figures.
Yeah. So let's see. What do we want to do? We take 32,400 times 5 divided by pi divided by 2. Okay, what we get, at least what I just got, is 257,831 point something. So that's the figure, and for comparison to that, the modern figure is 238. This now is in miles. So it's not exactly the same, but basically it's the same distance. So the Surya Siddhanta is presenting the moon as being about the same distance from the Earth as modern astronomy. So that is the situation there. So, yeah?
Is that 238,000 the mean or the max?
Yeah, it's average distance. It varies, of course. But that's the modern figure for the average distance between the Earth and the Moon. So that is the basic situation there. Now, in this comparison that I made between the planets moving in their orbits away from the ecliptic and the description in the Bhagavatam of distances above Bhoomandala, there's the obvious problem, of course, that the planet moves in this plane, so naturally it's not always at its furthest point away from the ecliptic. It'll be here at some point, and then down to this side and back, because it's going in a circular orbit. So, what I would propose is that, once again, we have the higher dimensional situation, which we're looking at from one perspective, and in the Bhagavatam it's being described from the perspective of the demigods. Now, there are some points, which Srila Prabhupada makes interestingly enough, that may possibly shed some light on this. At least I'll quote a little bit here from a letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote to Rupa Nuga in 1968.
reading from page what?
This is from page 84 at the bottom of the page. And it may shed some light on this. At least he's saying that planets can be mixed in terms of position within the universe. He says, regarding your question of the planetary systems, the planets are arranged in each universe in layers like the petals of a lotus, but in each layer there is mixed both heavenly, hellish, and middle planets. On the outside layer, there are these three kinds of planets. On the middle layer, there are the three kinds of planets. And on the innermost layer, there are found these three kinds of planets. Above these layers in the center is Brahma Loka, where Lord Brahma, the creator, is residing. So the earth planet and the moon planet are both in the same layer, but the earth is a middle planet and the moon is a heavenly planet. So that's what Srila Prabhupada stated there. Now, you can interpret it as well as I can, but in any event, he is speaking of a mixing up of the planets, and we can at least observe that in the Bhagavatam you have this arrangement of planets being described as having heights above the mandala, and the basic picture seems to correspond to the planets moving somewhat away from the plane of the ecliptic in the course of their orbits. At least that's the thing that corresponds to that in the modern astronomical picture. So that is the
In order to go, but the plane of the mandala is in another, is somewhere in some other dimension. Right?
Well, as we discussed yesterday,
we know what its projection is.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about when we speak of plane.
So it's going above and below, and its orbit is going above and below the projection.
Yes, that's relative to the projection into three-dimensional space. So the basic idea is that you have a higher dimensional situation. How much can we say in terms of trying to relate these different things?
Have you tried to make a fourth-dimensional model? Placing Bhumandala in some orientation where its projection is the ecliptic and where the planets might be and how they would...
I haven't tried anything that complex. Basically, I mean, possibly you could do something like that, and the problem would be, would there be a unique way to do it?
Or if there was just one, it would be encouraging.
Yeah. it's something to think about. This represents pretty much as far as I've gotten, but I've seen this basic kind of comparative relationship here. But undoubtedly there's a lot more to know about it. So, at least, though we do see a correspondence here, there was one other illustration I wanted to make concerning the interpretation of this. In the Bhagavatam, we're given a very simple and brief description of the universe. One can think of a subway map. This was a thought that occurred to me traveling on different subways, like in New York City. If you've ever seen these subway maps, it's a very simple grid, which contains just the information you need to know which stop to get off to, say, transfer to a line that will take you to another place where you need to go. If you look at a real map, like an actual map of Manhattan and Brooklyn and so on, you see that these lines snake all over in a somewhat curved, complicated path. Whereas on the subway maps, it's a very simple grid. So, you know, it can be like that also. At least that was just an image that occurred to me in reading this description in the Srimad Bhagavatam. At this point, I should also quote this statement by Sukadeva Goswami in the very beginning of the description, which is always good to keep in mind. That is, this is before he begins the description of Jambudvipa. It's text 4 of chapter 16 in the fifth canto. And he says, the great Rishi Sukadeva Goswami said, my dear king, there is no limit to the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's material energy. This material world is a transformation of the material qualities. Yet no one could possibly explain it perfectly, even in a lifetime as long as that of Brahma. No one in the material world is perfect, and an imperfect person could not describe this material universe accurately, even after continued speculation. O King, I shall nevertheless try to explain to you the principal regions such as Bhugalaka, with their names, forms, measurements, and various symptoms. So, we're definitely getting a simple description of something endlessly complex. You can also think of what happened when Krishna revealed the universal form to Arjuna. And he said, there are all these things that no one has seen before, which you'll now have the vision to see. So proceeding onward, there's some other points to make here. In this particular verse, there's the reference to Bhugolaka. This is somewhat of a technical point that is sometimes brought up. Gola means a globe in Sanskrit. It's a pretty definite meaning that it has. Mandala more or less means a disc or circular shape. If you look in the Sanskrit dictionaries, you'll usually find full lists of meanings for things. But a gola is a ball, so this says Bhugolaka. However, generally, Bhugola refers to the globe of the universe, not to the earth globe. So it is a globe 4 billion miles in diameter, and that refers to the inner shell of the universe. That point can be supported by various references. However, there are some references in the fifth canto which would seem to indicate the earth globe. And I'll give you some examples. Let's see, 521 here. Just thought I should say something about this topic. Let's see, 8 through 9. Yeah. Here's the statement. The living entities residing... Okay, let's see. This is fairly long. So it's describing the motion of the sun around Sumeru Mountain. It says, although the sun moves counterclockwise facing the constellations with Sumeru Mountain on its left, it also moves clockwise and appears to have the mountain on its right because it is influenced by the Dakshinavarta wind. People living in countries at points diametrically opposite to where the sun is first seen rising will see the sun setting. And if a straight line were drawn from a point where the sun is at midday, the people in countries at the opposite end of the line would be experiencing midnight. So the section toward the end here about people living in countries diametrically opposite to where the sun is rising would see the sun setting. That seems most reasonably to refer to the earth globe. Certainly that is what will happen on a globe. If you consider the point that if it's sunset at one point, then you go diametrically opposite, they should be seeing sunrise at that point on a globe. So, whereas in the case of the idea of a flat disk, it's hard to see how that would be. What do you mean diametrically opposite? And what do you even mean by sunrise?
What do you mean by diametrically?
Yeah, what do you mean by diametrically and what do you mean by sunrise and sunset? It's hard to make any sense out of that in terms of the idea of a disk, but in terms of the idea of a globe, you can see that, let's say at sunset, you go diametrically opposite to the other points, should be sunrise. Like that. So that's one reference. There's another one here. Let's see. Well, here again, this reference isn't much better than the one before. It's verse number 11. It's coming up. So there are some references then that would seem to refer to the earth globe concept. But generally, the references are to the earth as a... the Bhumandala disk.
Would it depend on the size of the planet, whether it's diametrically opposed at sunset or we're experiencing sunrise? had a smaller planet as one thing, a bigger planet as another.
Well, for a range of sizes in which it's not so big that the sun's rays diverge coming to it, it should be the same, because like this, if here's the planet, say you're looking down at the North Pole, so here comes sunlight, like this, and if we look at it in terms of the idea that the sun is going around this way, then sunset should be experienced here, because it's going around this way, so these rays are going to tilt like that, so then you won't see the sun anymore here. But just at that point, you're getting sunrise at this point. So, diametrically opposite, you see sunrise and sunset.
Assuming that it's parallel, sunlight's parallel.
Right. Which means if it's small enough, the sun is far enough away so that the rays are parallel. Now, if you had a small source of light like this and the rays diverge, it wouldn't be the same story. But assuming the rays are parallel, it'd be like that. So, that's just one point. Now, another point to make here has to do with this statement about the motion of the sun, which is interesting, because he's saying, although the sun moves counterclockwise facing the constellations with Sumeru Mountain on its left. So, let's think about what that means. If you're looking down from the north, Mount Meru is there, and the sun is going around like this. If it's going clockwise, counterclockwise, it's going like that. And then you can see Mount Meru will be on its left. So this corresponds to the yearly motion of the sun through the ecliptic, because that is the motion that goes this way. Opposing that motion, there would be the clockwise motion, which is daily, going this way. You can see if you go this way, you'll have Mount Meru on your right. So, it says there that the Dakshinavarta wind is blowing the sun around. That's the statement made here. It says, although the sun moves counterclockwise with Meru on its left, it seems to move with Mount Meru on its right because it's blown by the Dakshinavarta wind. So the idea in the Bhagavatam is that the Kala Chakra, in which the stars and planets are moving around once per day, that is powered by a wind. And Dakshinavarta wind is the name for that, and I believe that refers to rightward circumambulation. It's also called the Pravaha wind in other places. So the idea is by this wind, the sun is swept around in its daily motion clockwise, but its yearly motion counterclockwise, which is its motion along the path of the ecliptic, well, that's counterclockwise, and that goes with Mount Meru on the left. So this also basically supports the idea of the position of Bhumandala as being the ecliptic, because it is saying the basic movement of the sun is the counterclockwise movement, and it is swept around by the wind, which is more powerful in the other direction, so that gives it the clockwise movement, which is the daily rising and setting of the sun. Yeah?
That wind doesn't just blow the sun, it also blows the fixed stars.
It blows everything. All the planets, the whole system is carried by that wind. So that means the whole system is rotating once per day.
What we receive is the rotation of the, what scientists say is the rotation of the Earth.
Yeah. In modern terms, that's the rotation of the Earth. The idea is that the heavens and so on are actually fixed and the Earth is rotating. So in the Bhagavatam, that is described as the rotation of the whole system of stars, planets, sun, moon, and everything driven by this wind. And, you know, there's some illustrations that Srila Prabhupada makes of the influence of Maya, in which he refers to the idea that when you're carried by Maya, You don't notice it, just as a cloud carried by the wind doesn't notice anything. And if you think about that, imagine a cloud in a stream of wind. To the cloud, it's stationary, because it's just fixed relative to the wind. Only when you're on the ground and you see it blowing by, you recognize its motion and the motion of the wind. So if you apply that in this case, you have the picture in which, from our point of view, in which this wind is sweeping around, you see everything moved around with it. But from the point of view of those planets and so forth, in this atmosphere, because of course here the idea is outer space is not a vacuum, there's a kind of air out there, they're stationary within it, just like the cloud is stationary within that wind. So, from a relative point of view, you can see it in those two different ways.
That means the wind's moving awful fast, and planets are moving awful fast with the wind.
That means they're moving awful fast, but to one of those planets, relative to the wind, it's just standing still, and the air is standing still. You see? So again, you can think of it in relative terms. And that is, then the example of the person who is in Maya shows that relative concept also, because he doesn't see himself being carried by Maya. So to him, he's okay. Someone else who's stationary, not being carried by it, he can see that.
Well, someone who's stationary looking at those planets moving so fast, knowing that it's moving fast, they're moving fast.
They're moving very fast. So,
so someone who is up there on one of those planets is going to look down and see either the Earth globe or Bhumandala spinning around.
Relative to them, they seem to be spinning. Yeah?
So then, like, the yearly motion of the sun be like somebody on a merry-go-round walking in the other opposite direction as things spin through.
Right. And not only that, that's the next thing I was going to come to. The Bhagavatam has that very example, except it doesn't use a merry-go-round. He uses a potter's wheel. Yeah?
Did you say the Pravaha wind and the Dakshinavarta wind are the same?
I believe so.
So, what causes the counterclockwise motion?
The counterclockwise motion would be the sun traveling in its chariot, according to this understanding. And I'll give you another quotation that seems to me to agree with that picture. It's on page 80 of this book. It's from Sridhar Swami. This is from the commentary of Sridhar Swami on the Srimad Bhagavatam, translated by Shukavak. He says here, in commentary on 5.21.8-9, which is what I just read from the Bhagavatam, he says, although leftward movement facing the constellations is their own motion, swagatya, the luminaries, sun, moon, etc., move around Meru to the right daily, being blown by the Pravaha wind due to the power of the Kala Chakra. So that basically sums up the point that I was making. So they're saying, Sridhar Swami here is also saying the leftward motion, which is the counterclockwise motion, is their own motion, swagatya. So, concerning that merry-go-round example, that is described in 5.22.1-2. This is interesting. King Parikshit inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, my dear Lord, you have already affirmed the truth that the supremely powerful sun god travels around Dhruvaloka, and mind you, Dhruvaloka and Mount Meru are on one axis, so it's the same thing. Travels around Dhruvaloka with both Dhruvaloka and Mount Sumeru on his right. Yet at the same time, the sun god faces the signs of the zodiac and keeps Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on his left. How can we reasonably accept that the sun god proceeds with Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on both his left and right simultaneously? So King Parikshit asked Sukadeva Goswami this. Then Sri Shukadeva Goswami clearly answered, when a potter's wheel is moving and small ants located on that big wheel are moving with it, one can see that their motion is different from that of the wheel because they appear sometimes on one part of the wheel and sometimes on another. Similarly, the signs and constellations with Sumeru and Dhruvaloka on their right move with the wheel of time, and the ant-like sun and other planets move with them. The sun and planets, however, are seen in different signs and constellations at different times. This indicates that their motion is different from that of the zodiac and the wheel of time itself. So the picture then here is that as the whole Kala Chakra rotates, that's like the potter's wheel or the merry-go-round, and the sun and different planets have their own motion going around the other way, but it's slow. So they're carried with the Kala Chakra rotation. Meanwhile, they're moving the other way relative to that rotating wheel.
Do those other planets move at the same pace as the sun, their Svabhatra?
They move at different paces. And in fact, the Bhagavatam says something about that also. And that is the next point I wanted to come to, because here's a very interesting thing, which strikes me as giving some hint that there's really some deep astronomical knowledge behind the Bhagavatam. And this is a point I wanted to make, because the standard view of scholars and so on would be that this is very unscientific mythology. But you can see signs of sophisticated knowledge here. And this has to do with the three speeds of the sun. So, let's see, five, there are different verses here. 521.3 is one of these, according to this. It's said that the sun has three different speeds, fast, medium, and slow. So it says, okay, different things. Okay, it's describing the sun. While passing toward the north, toward the south, and through the equator, in accordance with the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is said, it's the sun here, it is said to move slowly, swiftly, or moderately. According to its movements, in rising above, going beneath, or passing through the equator, and correspondingly coming in touch with the various signs of the zodiac, headed by Makara, Capricorn, days and nights are short, long, or equal to one another. So the basic thing that's being described here is the motion of the sun along the ecliptic. The signs of the zodiac are distributed along the ecliptic. And there are names for these in Sanskrit also. So Makara is the sign of Capricorn, for example, is indicated here. So equator here refers to the celestial equator. And what is being mentioned in terms of the seasons is that when the sun is toward the north of the celestial equator on the ecliptic, on the celestial sphere, in the northern hemisphere, that's the period of summer, and the days are longer than the nights. Then when it's on the equator, there are two times when it's on the equator, and they're called the equinoxes. The day is equal to the night. And then when it goes down to the southern part of the ecliptic, beneath the equator, then that's winter in the northern hemisphere. Of course, in the southern hemisphere, this is reversed. But the Bhagavatam is speaking of winter in terms of the northern hemisphere, summer and winter and so forth. But in addition to this fact, which is well known to everyone, namely that the days have different lengths during the different seasons, the point is made that the sun moves slowly, swiftly, or moderately when it's in these different parts. Basically, what it is saying is that the sun is moving faster during the winter period, slower during the summer period. Now, modern Western commentators on Puranas have said, well, this represents a very naive idea in the Bhagavatam, or in the Puranas. Actually, the commentary, one commentary I read on this, I think it was H.H. Wilson's Vishnu Purana, which I was looking at to compare with the fifth canto in the Bhagavatam. Different Puranas have parallel passages to the Bhagavatam. So, in any case, you can argue that, yeah, what they say is, well, the Bhagavatam is giving a very simplistic view because it is saying that, all right, when the day is longer, that means the sun is traveling slower during the day, so it's in the sky longer. And in the winter, when the days are shorter, it must be traveling faster, so it gets over faster, and the days are shorter. So how naive. But if you look at this carefully, you can see that it's not the daily motion of the sun which is being referred to, but the motion of the sun through the ecliptic that's actually being referred to here. One reason for that, let me see, 5:22, 8. Turn to that. Okay. Yeah, here's one clear reason for that. In 5:22:7, it says the sun god has three speeds, slow, fast, and moderate, so it refers to that again. And then next it talks about the moon and the motion of the moon through its orbit against the background of the fixed stars on the celestial sphere. And it says, the moon, which travels at a speed faster than that of the sun. In two lunar fortnights, the moon travels through the equivalent of a samvatsara of the sun. In 2 1/4 days, it passes through a month of the sun, and in one day, it passes through a fortnight of the sun. So, it's saying the moon is moving faster than the sun. So in what sense does the moon move faster than the sun? Well, in its motion against the stars, the sun takes a year to go around, and the moon takes 1 month. So the moon is going much faster. In fact, these figures here back that up. If you, 2 lunar fortnights, that'd be a total month, and the moon travels through the equivalent of a samvatsara of the sun, and so on and so forth. Basically, it's referring to the fact that the moon is going around about 12 times as fast as the sun. That's the movement against the fixed stars, which is this leftward movement. In terms of the movement caused by the rotation of the Kala Chakra, the moon actually goes a bit slower than the sun, because the time from moonrise to another moonrise is a bit longer than the time from sunrise to another sunrise, due in fact to the fact that the moon is going back faster than the sun is. If you think about that, you see, because the moon is going back faster than the sun is, then the time from moonrise to another moonrise will be a bit longer than the time from sunrise to another sunrise, because the moon's going a bit further back, and you have to rotate a bit more to bring it to the point of rising again.
The moon is also higher.
But right now we're just considering
against the
path against the background of the stars.
Okay.
Against the background of the stars, you see, like this globe, if you think of that as the celestial sphere, one great circle around that is the ecliptic. So the moon moves in its great circle, which is at a slight angle to the ecliptic. The moon is moving faster along its path than the sun is. So the fact that it says the moon is moving faster than the sun, right after this verse about the three speeds of the sun, would certainly indicate that it's the three speeds of the sun as it moves through the ecliptic that are being referred to. So that brings us to an interesting point concerning modern astronomy. And that is that, in fact, in the winter, the sun is moving faster against the background of stars than it is during the summer. And the explanation of that in modern astronomy, in heliocentric terms, we could use this same diagram, is that the Earth has an elliptical orbit, and there's the thing of the aphelion and the perihelion. The perihelion is the point in its orbit where it's closest to the sun, and the point in its orbit where it's furthest from the sun is the aphelion. So the Earth is moving more slowly around the sun when it's further away than when it's closer. In modern terms, that's explained in terms of gravitation. When it's further away, the pull of gravity is weaker, and it doesn't have to go as fast to have centrifugal force to balance the pull of the sun. So when it comes in, it's just like the idea is if two people are swinging one another around, as they do in kirtan sometimes. And if you pull in, then you swing faster. And if you stretch your arms out, you swing slower. So the idea is that the Earth goes slower when it's further, faster when it's closer, but the time when it's closer is in the winter, as it turns out. It's very close to what is called the winter solstice, which is the deepest point of winter in terms of the motion of the sun. It's when the days are shortest, which is around Christmas time. So According to modern astronomy, in fact, the sun does go more slowly at that time and more rapidly during the summer. Yeah?
Isn't the distance covered on its path relatively constant? But it seems like it's going faster or slower because of the distance.
No, the idea in modern science is that it's actually going faster when it's coming closer. I mean, closer to the sun.
Like the example of the Potter's wheel, if something's measured close to the center, it's going roughly the same. It's covering the same distance less than if it's on the outside. It's covering a greater distance with the same amount of time. So it would seem that the inner object would be going slower than the outer object.
Yeah, but keep in mind though, the Potter's wheel there corresponds to the Kala Chakra, the daily rotation. And here we're talking about the yearly rotation. So I would argue then that the sort of naive dismissal of the Quranic cosmology that the scholars give is not really valid. And it's the Puranas here are, the fifth canto at any rate, is referring to something that's not so obvious to an unscientific person. In other words, you'd need a little bit of astronomical sophistication to know that the sun's going slower in the summer against the stars than in the winter. I should mention, by the way, that the Surya Siddhanta also has it going slower and faster in the same way. The formulas of the Surya Siddhanta give you that effect also.
And what reason do they give for it?
They don't give reasons. They just give a formula. It's called a thing called the Mandochcha. Anyway, that's...
Then there's no concept of elliptical orbits.
In the Surya Siddhanta, there's no idea mentioned of elliptical orbits or gravity or anything like that. That's all the idea in modern science. So, at this point, I thought I'd have a historical interlude. This really relates to the question of the dissemination of Vedic culture throughout the world. At least there is evidence that at some point in the past, Vedic culture has gotten around the world to quite an extent, and some hints of this arise in connection with astronomy. One interesting point has to do with the days of the week, so I just thought I'd mention that. There are, on pages 88 and 89, there are two tables of the days of the week. The interesting thing is we have them in Sanskrit, English, and Latin. And these are planet names in each case. And it turns out that they're the same. They correspond to one another. So, just for example, Sunday obviously refers to the sun. Tuesday isn't as obvious, but that does refer to the planet Mars. It's the Anglo-Saxon version of Mars. But Martes dies in Latin. What is it? Martes in Spanish?
French is Mardi.
Yeah. Merdi in French. Like Mercury, Mercredi, isn't it?
Yeah.
In Sanskrit, it's Buddha Bar. Buddha is Mercury. So, in general, the days of the week are named after the planets in the order Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn.
Japanese.
It is? Really? Did they get that? Someone's going to ask if they got that recently from...
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Just from the West.
Could be.
It'd be interesting if it's ancient in Japan. Because the question is, how did this come about historically? Now, you can read that the English names came ultimately from the Latin names back in the days of the Roman Empire. That's what will be argued. And the Romans got these names from the Greeks. Now the scholars will want to say the Greeks really originated this. And they'll say the Indians also got this from the Greeks, because this is in India also. But, of course, who can say definitely what happened thousands of years ago? But it turns out that in the Surya Siddhanta, there's a calculation for determining the order of the days of the week. So, in this table, they're listed. It goes Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. it's a little bit hard to understand here is why Mercury comes before Venus. But sometimes Mercury is closer to us than Venus. You know, it depends on how they are in their orbits. But that's the order that's chosen in the Sirius Vedanta in any case. So you could look at it, but then they're further than the sun, and sun comes first. So that would be a bit inconsistent with that. But
why Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are further from the Earth than the sun is?
They are. At least most of the time. Now, the question is, when Mars has a close approach to the Earth, does it come closer than the Earth to sun distance? I have to check that. But most of the time, surely Mars is further from the Earth than the sun. Same with Jupiter and Saturn. So this, in any event, is the order from the Earth adopted in the Sirius Siddhanta. Now, in the Sirius Siddhanta, it's described that the successive 30-day months are associated with the planets in this order. Seven successive months are given planet names in this order, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, etc. And then you start over for the next 7 months and keep repeating them in that way. And it's described that the days of the week also have planet names, and you set it up so that the day that falls on the beginning of a month will have the same planet name as the planet name of that month. So that rule is given. Now, if you think about that, plot it out on a piece of paper, you'll see that that gives you the order of the day names in the week. There's a calculation. It's the remainder of 30N divided by 7. But anyway, that'll be incomprehensible unless you work it out on a piece of paper. But if you're interested, you can do that. But the main point is you get this strange order of Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn, which is the order of the days in the week. So that's contained in the Sirius Siddhanta then. So that's an interesting point concerning the historical connections. I just thought I would mention a couple of other interesting cultural connections that show up. One of these is illustrated in a picture on page 64, which I've always been kind of intrigued by. This is a picture of the Earth according to Norse mythology. And basically, it's a picture of Jambudvip. Because what they have is a circular island. This is a very tall mountain in the center of the island. And on the top of the mountain, there's this place called Asgard, which is the city of the gods. So, after all, Jambudvip is circular, and there's Mount Meru, and at the top of Mount Meru, there's Brahmapuri. So, there are interesting connections that you can see like that. Now, as far as I'm aware, we just don't know the history behind these things at all. That is, how did the Norse, these are the people who are the Vikings and so on and so forth, where did they get Jambudvip, essentially, as their image of the Earth? I mentioned a number of other historical connections of this kind. All kinds of different nations had the idea of a Mount Meru. In fact, probably everyone's heard of the Greeks had Mount Olympus, and the gods lived on top of Mount Olympus. And there are many other examples like this. So the idea of the fifth canto cosmology seems to have been widespread in a lot of different cultures.
Can you give another example?
Well, for Mount Meru, here's a whole bunch of them. I'll just read this. This is from a book called Shamanism by Marcia Eliade. But he says, in Central Asia, the names for the central mountains, such as Sumber, Sumer, and Summer, are clearly related to the Sanskrit name Sumeru. Then the Greeks, Mount Olympus. For the Iranians, they had something, Haraberetzvatai or something. In Germans had a version of this called Himing George. I cannot pronounce that. Oh, you can pronounce that.
Himing George.
Okay. Chinese, they had a Mount Kunlun. So there are a number of other examples here. This Needham wrote this book, Science and Civilization in China. And he noted that in China, they have maps of the world which were circular with a central mountain. He calls them wheel maps. And he is thinking, well, he's not sure if they came from India or Babylon. But he points out that in any case, the Babylonians had such maps. So there are a lot of different appearances of this basic picture. But as far as I know, we really don't know much about the history behind this. There's one other example that I give here that always intrigued me. This has to do with the Sioux Indians, no less. It seems that the Sioux Indians tell that the world goes through a cycle of four ages. And they say there's a buffalo, a sacred buffalo in the West, who loses one leg during each successive age. And at present it has only one leg. It also loses hair during the successive ages. So at present it has only one leg, and this is an age of degradation. Yeah, so that's from the Sioux Indians now. I don't know how they got that.
Study Central America?
Well, yeah, that's another whole topic. I give one example here of what has been interpreted. This is on page 67. I put it in because it seems like a reasonable interpretation, although, as I point out, you can't be absolutely sure about these things. But here you have a number of beings holding a serpent, and there's a tortoise there. Some have interpreted this as referring to the churning of the milk ocean. The tortoise could be the Kermit incarnation and so on. The point, of course, I make in the book is this also shows the tantalizing and frustrating nature of these things, that you never can be sure. But there are a lot of hints of Vedic themes represented all over the world in different cultures. But they seem to appear today in the form of fragments, which are unrecognized. They're sort of like cultural fossils, you might say. There's one more that I'd like to mention. Let's see, this is on page 63. I ran across this. I thought it was pretty good. This is from Norse mythology again. Now they say that at the time of the destruction of the cosmos, which they call Ragnarok, this is on page 63. It's in the middle of page 63. At the time of the destruction of the cosmos, all engulfing flames come out of Surt the Black. This Surt is said to be the king of eternal bliss at the southern end of the sky. It is also stated in the Norse myths that there are many good abodes and many bad. Best it is to be in Gimli with Surt. So, what does that remind one of? Yeah. At least it's reminiscent of that. So I don't know where they got ideas like that. But then finally there's one other thing that I'll mention. And this is, there's a book by two scholars called De Santillana and von Dekkend. It's a book on mythology. Basically they're looking at myths and so forth from all over the world. So in their studies, they came to the conclusion that there was something that they called an archaic culture, which had worldwide dispersal. And they're trying to reconstruct the worldview of these archaic people based on looking at all these myths. Now, the book, of course, as you can imagine, is highly speculative, but it's interesting to see the conclusion they come to here. They're asking, what these archaic people thought about the earth. So they say, first, what was the earth? In the most general sense, the earth was the ideal plane laid through the ecliptic. The dry earth, in a more specific sense, was the ideal plane through the celestial equator. The name true earth, or the inhabited world, did not in any way denote our physical geoid for the archaics. It applies to the band of the zodiac, 24 degrees to the right and left of the ecliptic. So, this is their conclusion based on their studies. But the interesting thing is it corresponds to this picture of Bhumandala that we've been discussing here as the earth, as described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is a bit of historical material, which I think this, with further study, could be expanded. Yeah?
Couldn't Socrates also have this view of his planes and Bhumandala or something? And he said that Earth was only part of this big plane direction, right?
I'm not sure. I know, I think Hesiod, the Greek poet, had something also along these lines, I seem to recall. I don't recall anything with regard to Socrates, but that may be.
Are there certain Vedic sayers that at one time the Earth globe was covered with water?
Yep. But the Earth that was covered with water, actually, if you look in the Bhagavatam, it never says that the Earth globe was covered with water. The Earth was covered with water. And in fact, that was the point that I made the other day with regard to that purport by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary on the Bhagavatam, namely that it's the whole Bhumandala that sinks into the Garbhagak ocean and is raised up by Lord Varaha. He makes that point. So it's the whole thing. So the next point that I wanted to come to had to do with distances, the scale of the universe. So thus far we've been talking about Bhumandala, which is 4 billion miles in diameter. So that's quite large for the Earth, but if you regard that as the diameter of the universe, it seems exceedingly small. So the basic description you have in the Bhagavatam is that, looking at this from the side, if this is Bhumandala and Jambudvipa is in the center, then there's a shell. Let me correct this by moving that to the center of it. A spherical shell basically centered on Jambudvipa. And all of the different planetary systems and so forth within the universe are contained within that shell. That's the basic description. Actually, the shell is subdivided into seven layers. Each one of them is 10 times as thick as the one within it. And once you go through all of those seven layers, you come out into the causal ocean. And so the total structure is called the Brahmanda, or universe. And it's described that in the causal ocean, there are innumerable Brahmandas floating like bubbles of foam within the ocean. And of course, this causal ocean is part of the Mahatattva, and that's where the material creation takes place. That's surrounded by the Viraja River, and on the other side of that is the spiritual world. That's the basic layout. So one might say, well, if this diameter here is 4 billion miles, that's very small. So it turns out that there's some other information, though, which is relevant to this. And let's see. I'm looking for my reference. Okay, page 30 in this book. So there's a text in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is interesting. This is Madhya Lila, chapter 21, verse 84, in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So in the text, Krishna said, "Your particular universe extends 4 billion miles. Therefore, it is the smallest of all the universes, Consequently, you have only four heads. So Krishna is speaking to Brahma. He's mentioning this 4 billion mile figure. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, one of the greatest astrologers of his time, gives information from Siddhanta Shiromani that this universe measures, and here's a rather big number that you can read. I won't read it. This is the circumference of this universe. According to some, this is only half the circumference. Right. So, this is why scientists use this power of 10 notation. You know, 1.8712 about times 10 to the, how many zeros? 16. 10 to the 16th power. So that's a rather large number. Times 8 means it's in yojanas. Because Srila Prabhupada's using 8 miles per yojana.
And just to explain where that figure comes from.
Yes, I've looked it up. So Srila Prabhupada, of course, gives us the hint here. He says that it's quoted from Siddhanta Shiromani. And in fact, in the Siddhanta Shiromani, you'll find this. And in the Siddhanta Shiromani, an explanation is given as a somewhat enigmatic statement that this is the circumference of the universe. According to some, this is only half the circumference. So the answer to that is the following, as it turns out. This is the circumference of the region bounding that area where the sun's rays are visible. It is so stated in the Siddhanta Shiromani. Now, there are two ways to look at it, and this is also stated in the Siddhanta Shiromani. One is that the sun's rays go all the way to the shell of the universe. And in that case, this is the circumference of that shell, circularly going around. The other is, though, that after all, Mount Loka Loka, the Loka Loka mountain that we were referring to yesterday, blocks the rays of the sun. And it's situated radially halfway out from the center. So then, according to that view, this circumference is really the circumference of Loka Loka Mountain. So it's half the circumference of the universe. So that's the meaning of that part of the statement. So the situation then is we have this very big number being cited here, and it's cited by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. In fact, I checked this, the commentary by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati to the Chaitanya Charitamrita for this verse, and indeed he cites this there. Srila Prabhupada is just mentioning his reference. So, what can we say about this? First of all, I should say something about how big this is to give an idea. You can calculate what the radius is, this is the circumference, so if you divide by 2 pi, you'll get the radius. You can convert this into light years. You know this figure, light years. Light travels at 186,000 miles in a second. And so if you figure out how many seconds there are in a year and multiply by that, that is the distance light travels in a year, so that's called one light year. So the radius that this corresponds to from the center out to this beginning of the coverings, or from the center out to the Loka Loka Mountain, depending on which way you look at it, that comes out to 5,077 light years. So that becomes a more respectable distance. Even in modern scientific terms, that would include a lot of stars, although it wouldn't include the whole Milky Way galaxy, just to give you a...
Would not.
What is it? You see, the trouble is the size of the Milky Way galaxy changes. So you have to remember which source you're getting your figures from. I remember 10,000 light years, and I remember 100,000.
I just read something around 100,000.
100,000. So maybe that's the up-to-date size figure. Yeah.
Is there an idea in...
that the universe expands and contracts?
In the Vedic literature?
Yeah, as well as in modern.
Well, it certainly expands at a certain point, but there's no indication that it expands in the Big Bang fashion. And the impression I get, at any rate, is that once the creation is established, it's not expanding anymore. It's full grown, so to speak. That's certainly the impression I get. Yeah?
But wasn't Arjuna just very tall figures?
Well, that may be. But
wasn't the universe expanded at that time?
Well, I have no indication that the whole universe is.
Or how were they accommodated if there's just tall figures?
Well, people could be bigger, but there's room. I certainly see no particular reason to link the size of higher stature of people with, you know, expanding the universe. One thing to keep in mind, though, of course, is I can say that right at this moment, I'm going to cause all lengths to double. See, it happens. All lengths are doubled. And, of course, if you try and measure this with a yardstick now, you'll still get the same distance because that doubled too. Because all the lengths doubled. So, in any case, we have this information. I wanted to say, by the way, that in the Surya Siddhanta and in the Siddhanta Shiromani, you find the same large figure, and it's also indicated there how this is calculated. And I won't write down the numbers, but it's on page 32 in the book. But basically, it's calculated based on the motion of the moon, interestingly enough. And basically, the distance that the moon covers in its orbit in one day of Brahma is this figure, this distance for the circumference. That's how you calculate it. I don't know. It's not explained why, but that's the way it is, because the figure involves taking this 57,753,000, etc., which is the number of revolutions of the moon in one chakra yuga, which is 4,320,000 years, times 1,000 for 1,000 yuga cycles in one day of Brahma, times the circumference of the moon's orbit, and that equals this number. So that's where it comes from in terms of the calculation. So the question then is, how are we to understand this? What I would suggest is that since Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, certainly, and of course Srila Prabhupada is following him, is just giving us a gigantic distance figure right after Krishna is saying to Brahma in the verse, the 4 billion mile figure, without offering any explanation of the relation between these two, it would seem both figures must apply. So one can ask, how could both figures apply? I can't say that I know definitely, but one idea that comes to mind is this concept that there could be different scales for beings in different levels of consciousness.